Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello there. Welcome to The Phil Hayes Show. It's brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. You can get in touch with the show via the new Twitter account at The Phil Hayes Show. My name's Dan Moylan and I'm joined by Michael Normanton from The Square Ball.
Hello.
Phil Hayes recovering from his surgery, the surgery he had at the back end of April. Got his first checkup this next week as well. Pleased to say Phil is recovering well. Before he was off, we recorded that top 10 signings feature that's running every week for 10 weeks. So you'll still get to hear a little bit of Phil's voice on the podcast. We started that a couple of weeks ago. This week, we will bring you his number 8 signing from the time that he's been covering Leeds United the last 15 years or so. While Phil is absent, we are going to have guests in from the world of Leeds United. Next week is going to be a treat slash pandemonium slash a lot of fun, very informative, when we get on Leeds United's director of football, Victor Orta, on the Phil Hayes Show. But this week, a very warm welcome to Josh Warrington. Hiya, Josh. You all right?
Hiya, mate. Hiya, mate. And that'll be a fantastic show with Victor. He's a character.
Well, we look forward to that one. And right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months. 40% off the full price of a sub. You get all the great analysis, the in-depth features from the best team of football writers on the planet. You get all these podcasts ad-free as well. James Horncastle has done a bit on Rodrigo de Paul this week, which is a really, really interesting read. We're going to have a little bit of a chat with James a little bit later on in this podcast, so stick around for that. In the meantime, if you want to sign up for The Athletic, head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod to take advantage of the 40% discount. theathletic.com/LeedsPod. Into the football, and Josh, you're a champion, and we're seeing a great evolution of this side in the last week. We've seen some brilliant performances from a club that has undoubtedly cemented its place now in the Premier League with victories against Burnley 4-0 and Southampton 2-0. How do you reflect on the last week?
I think it's easy to talk in hindsight, but you know, go to start of the season, I thought that games like your Southamptons and your Burnleys that we'd be having results like that. And obviously, start of season were fantastic with some results going our way, some results not. But I always thought that we'd be a little bit too much for, you know, I don't know, it's easy to say average teams of Premier League because they're all good teams, but obviously there's a bit of a gap where the money's involved, like your Man Cities and your bigger teams. But I always thought we'd be able to deal with rested teams. So not surprised to see that, to be honest with you. But it probably even more than I expected, to be honest with you, because we're absolutely destroying them. You know, in terms of play, and it's as though the players have been playing in Premier League for years and years. You wouldn't have thought that they've just come up from the Championship, so it's very satisfying. Obviously, you don't want the season to end now, and for all those critics who've said that we're going to burn out and whatnot, we're kind of peaking now. We're peaking.
How much of these last two victories do you put down to it being end of season, or is it just that we're seeing Leeds United on the rise?
I don't know. I think it's maybe a bit on the rise. Maybe, obviously, these lads who've come in, it's going to take a little bit while to gel together. But, you know, now they've had them games together and Bielsa's experimented with what his strongest team is and, you know, who works best with who. I think they've started to cement together and this is just the products of that, really. The, you know, getting that experience at a high level. Obviously, it'll be a shock to the system for a lot of them. You know, I've only just played in the Championship and or below. It comes down to timing, doesn't it? You know, in all sports, you know, we come down to timing and peaking, and these guys are peaking. And if we have a little bit of a break over the summer, I know there's be a few doing international duty, but, you know, come back and where we left off and we're going to be a real dominant force next season. And we have been this season, but we're talking like aiming for Europe spots and things like that.
Talking about conditioning then, you know, you're somebody who's going to obviously understand that as a boxer. What do you see when you look at this Leeds team and this squad in terms of their conditioning and how they've done it?
The fitness is massive key. And it's easy to say, yeah, everyone should be fit, but there's levels to that fitness as well. And I try to focus a lot on, and I always have done throughout my career, on being able to keep a strong mindset when you get tired. So, for instance, if I go out and I'm doing a game plan or whatever, if my trainers are telling me to throw certain shots, it's easy to do in round one, round two, because you're fresh, you're constantly thinking about it. You're going into round nine, round 10, where championship rounds where your body's tired, your arms are tired, your muscles are aching, and things don't come, you know, to the grey matter as quick as they should do. And that's same in all sports. And when the players listening to instruction and tactics and stuff, it'll flow in first 10, 15, 20 minutes, depending on how the game's going as well. And when they're highly competitive, when it gets into the late second half, then like 70, 80th minute, that's where things can fall apart, especially, like I say, if it's been a 9-10-city game end to end. But this squad, they're that fit that they don't lose that edge upstairs. They're all fully focused, they're all switched on. And you know that goals could come any time in the match, and they can still play that intensity but stay switched on. And that's massive. That's somewhat what comes with having the highest level of fitness, because, like I say, the Premier League has got some of the world's best footballers in it, but we're matching them, and that's just through the hard work that they've been putting on the training pitch.
So, you know, when that tiredness sets in, when you say late on in a game, what do you fall back on at that point? Is that your training? Is that your fitness, where you do the things that you've done 1,000 times? Is it repetition?
Exactly, yeah. Kind of instinct. You'll fall back on instinct. And, you know, sometimes that's a good thing, but sometimes it's a bad thing, because say you've got like a certain mistake and you've only just ironed out that mistake. So Bielsa's been in the club a few years now, hasn't he? And it may have wiped out some of the mistakes that some players make. Liam Cooper, for example, say, for instance, Cooper's got a weaker side where players might be able to get him on a weaker side. But through Bielsa, he's been able to strengthen that and stop players going down his weaker side. But when tiredness comes in, then it revert back to some of that he's always done, like bad habits, because they're hard to eliminate completely when you've been doing it for so long, especially like so Liam Cooper would have been, you know, 27 or so before Bielsa came in. So it'd be hard to completely eliminate that. And when you get tired, you'd revert back to just that normal. But being able to keep a strong head upstairs is down to your fitness and the testament to your fitness. And that'll mean make sure that, you know, the correct decision making will be right, and it'll stop him from falling back into them old mistakes.
You obviously know some of the players from your ring walks and things, and people like Liam Cooper. Have you spoken to them much about how things have changed at Leeds and how the coaching has developed?
I've seen it myself firsthand, but obviously not so much in this last season. But I tell you, when I was getting ready for the Lee Selby fight a few years ago, Thomas Christiansen was in, and we were doing a promo for the Selby fight. We were doing a bit of a build up, and out down Allen Road, down up at Thorpe Arch, and I had a little bit of a walk around you know, the training ground and whatnot. I've been there quite a few times now, but I'm a nosy bastard, to be honest with you. I like to have a little wander around when I can, because obviously no matter how many times you've been, I'm a Leeds fan, and it excites you every time. And even just speaking to some of the players, for instance, I was talking to on that day, I was talking to Ronnie Vieira and Calvin, and I was just asking about like the training and and I were asking about the diet and things like that. And really all it was, you know, Calvin said to me, oh, we get given a diet sheet, you know, and some lads follow it, some lads don't. And I'm right, right, okay, right, interesting. And, you know, how do you approach this? Well, we don't really look at that too much. What about mindset? What about psychology? No, we don't really do too much of that stuff. And then after the Slobby fight, I boxed Carl Frampton and we went up to training ground again to do a little promo. And whilst I was there, I got introduced to, what's his bloody name now, the manager, the player's manager.
Is it Matt Grice, is he called, or something?
Yes, that's the one, Matt. So we seen Matt, and he just started talking about a few things, and I started talking about conditioning and whatnot. And he said, come and meet some of the new staff. And like I say, with the transition had been, 5-6 months in difference? And it was unbelievable, the changes that I'd seen. Like, as I went into the initial gym, where last time, it just, you know, it was a gym. This time, there were just data sheets all over the walls. You know, I'm speaking to a load of different faces that I've never seen before. And obviously, I like to pick these people's heads, you know, ask questions and how they flourish and how the, you know, the peak and the conditioning and things like that. And right on the walls there was graphics. They're telling me about how all the players getting weight, the body fat. They're telling me about the recovery, how important that is, how, you know, Marcelo is all for recovery and sleep. And all these things are obvious and they've come out in articles and press and stuff like that. But I think it sometimes gets overlooked. And I think at the time we were getting rid for Brentford. And the data of Brentford was all over the room. And I'm thinking, this is absolutely crazy. There's levels to it in there. There's levels. And since, like, speaking of Liam and Stewie and things like that, I said, what is it like? You know, obviously, we all read and listen to his interviews and things like that, but, you know, man to man, he said, honestly, you know, they've all spoke very highly of him. He said that he's an unbelievable people's person. Like, everybody wants to get his respect. He's pushing us to work even harder. And it's just the little things that he comes over and like, you know, self-player management, you know, individually up in everyone's game. So it's fantastic to see. And, you know, you kind of don't want to think of a day without Marcelo Bielsa being at the club, do you? You look at him and what he's done with his squad, it's unbelievable, really.
Just to tap back into something that you said there, Josh, actually, about some of the lads following the diet sheets and some not before Bielsa.
Yeah. Yeah.
It strikes me that there's more of a culture of respect, but also of accountability in that squad. And if you don't take responsibility for yourself and the things that you're doing, you're never going to succeed, I suppose.
Yeah, most definitely. But I think it goes beyond just them as individuals. I think there's been a different philosophy altogether brought into the club, not even just with Marcelo, but with how the club is run, with the club being put back to community kind of stands. I mean, 2014, 15, 16, and prior to Radvazani coming in, when did you ever see players going into hospitals? It died off. All that died off. Leeds is a one club city, and it's at the football club is the heartbeat of the city. And it kind of lost its way with the city, with the, you know, one-to-one meet and greets and, you know, hospital visits, players going out of children wards. And, you know, obviously, over the last 2 years, it's been difficult with COVID and stuff, but the players are in touch. They're in touch with the city, and that's a massive difference. And we know when Calvin had told me that about, you know, some of the players not following the diet sheets, I thought to myself, you know what? If some of the lads I know who've not missed games in 20, 30 years, who've sacrificed their own weddings, funerals, birthday parties, and they heard, if they had them players then and they knew that they weren't following whatever was put out to them to make them the very, very best, these guys would be absolutely fuming, because it's home and away, isn't it? You know, as a fan, and I know some fans who were absolutely crazy. I mean, I'm a massive Leeds fan, but, you know, I don't dress my dogs in Leeds United shirts and things. But I know that some fans do, and it means beyond anything that you could imagine. And I think that's the difference there. Obviously, these boys who were all part of the squad, they understand, you know, I think they realise how much, you know, Leeds United is to people's lives. And I think that makes the difference, because obviously they've got the respect of Marcelo. They want to impress Marcelo as much as possible. They don't want to be turning up to the training ground having to get weighed and being overweight, or they've put a little bit on, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. But also they don't want to let the fans down as well.
And no doubt they haven't let the fans down. They've done brilliantly this season. And we're looking at, what, maybe an 8th, 9th, 10th place position finish. I think that's what a return for the first season. It's amazing, isn't it?
I thought that we could finish quite high. I mean, I wouldn't say we're going to be like, yeah, top four or like that, but I thought we could make it into top top end of the table. I'm sure I'll have told some kind of media outlet. And reason that I'd thought that, I mean, I'm not no football expert, or I'm not done as much as data as some of the fans out there, but just when I watched us down at Arsenal and in FA Cup, when we're in Championship still, and like, all right, Arsenal put the foot down in second half, and the class came out in that second half. But for that first half, we absolutely battered them. And, you know, I always thought that we'd be too much for, you know, the teams who haven't got the mega money. And even the teams who have got mega money, we've stood toe-to-toe with them, haven't they? I mean, it's been fantastic to watch. And I think they've got this season under the belt, they've settled in. They've grown accustomed to it. It's all experience. And by the time next season comes back and the fans are allowed, they'll be ready for anything. And they won't let the pressures, and it's not all new territory and things like that. So as a fan, you've got to be very, very happy with it.
I think the danger for next season is there's been such a lot of momentum with us this past 2 years that people will be expecting top four next year. And if if we finish 10th again next year, people will start getting pissed off, won't they? But that's the danger, really, isn't it, that we... When it feels like things are going right, it feels like we're unstoppable at the moment. And if as soon as that stops, I guess that's when the test comes on it.
Yeah, and I think that's where we just need to remind ourselves and just give ourselves a slap around the chops that things have been a lot worse, and haven't they? We've got to just take everything, you know, as it is. It's unbelievable football to watch. I mean, it's been said many, many times this season, but we've become like a football fan's second team, haven't we? You know, they might have the initial team with the following, and then the second team is the watching Leeds United. And as Leeds fans, that's weird to hear, but he says it's that good of football we're playing. And yeah, there will be an expectation, but we always expect high from our club, don't we? So I think they'll ride with it, mate. I think they'll ride with it, honestly. And I think it can only help, because that energy spills into it comes in the ground with the fans, and that spills onto the pitch. And if we can get that right momentum going at the start of the season, then you know, Elland Road can become, you know, a fortress, and you know, matches a little bit to and fro, it can give him a positive boost.
Well, Phil's off at the minute, recovering from his hospital stay, but we've kept your voice on the podcast, Phil, haven't we? We've recorded these a little while ago. Your top 10 signings since 2006, the 15 years that you've been covering Leeds United. So far, we've had Paddy Kisnorbo at number 10, Robert Snodgrass, number 9. Who's your number 8?
Yeah, hopefully I'm not dead by now. Otherwise, these are going to get very, very weird as we go. Number 8, Luciano Becchio. Came from Spain, originally from Argentina, and arrived in pre-season when Leeds were over in Ireland. They had 3 games over in Ireland under McAllister. And he turned up with his boots. He had braces on his teeth. He had sort of classic South American long hair. And I think at the time, Leeds were quite prone to trialists in that sort of scattergun recruitment approach where you bring them in, you kind of hope they might be great, but most of them turn out not to be good enough and you never see them again. And it was David Prutton who said the first time Becchio turned up, you did think, who is this guy? And he couldn't really speak any English, and you assumed that he'd be gone in no time and that would be that. But as soon as he started training and as soon as they started seeing what he was doing, straight away, they all said to each other, he's got some talent, this lad. He looks like a very good centre forward and a very good finisher. And one of the things that stands out in my head early on with Becchio was him coming off the bench for the first game of the start of McAllister's second season in League One. It was away at Scunthorpe. And with one of his first touches, hitting the bar from about 25 yards with this shot that wasn't really there to be taken. But it was a bit speculative, and he just leathered it from miles out and almost stuck it in the top corner. And he, I think the best thing you can say about Becchio, the biggest feather in his cap, is the fact that he made the top 10 list of league goal scorers at Elland Road, which is, you know, there's hardly anybody in there from the modern era. And it's very, very difficult to break into a little group like that. But he was just a hugely reliable goal scorer. And a little bit like Snodgrass, I felt that towards the end, before he was sold, he was basically carrying Leeds on, you know, in the respect that nobody else was scoring goals. Even when he was playing poorly, he was coming up with goals. And I think he had 19 mid-season when he finally left for Norwich and was sold by Warnock. And just all-round quality player. And actually, when I interviewed him about a year ago for The Athletic as well, really nice guy as well.
190 appearances, 75 goals. We spoke last week when Robert Snodgrass, it was heartbreaking when he left. This one, this killed us, didn't it?
It certainly did when we saw what we were getting in return. I think one of the nice things with Becchio was that it always felt like he was absolutely maximising every bit of talent he had. It felt to me like he couldn't have given Ennis any more. And it was almost a nice story that he'd come from obscurity and that it felt like we'd grown together to a point up to the extent where he decided, actually, maybe I am a bit better than this and I could maybe have a little stint in the Premier League.
I think as well, he didn't feel, from what he said to me, and there are always two sides to these stories, so you need to be sceptical on both fronts, but he didn't feel that even though it was portrayed as Becchio forcing his way out or Becchio looking for better opportunities, he didn't feel that there was any sense at all of Leeds particularly being bothered about keeping him. But when you got to the point of Becchio leaving, you suddenly realised that just about everything that had been good about that team had gone. Snodgrass had gone, Housen had gone, Beckford had gone, Gradle had gone, now Becchio was leaving. And there was very little left, you know, but even guys like Johnson and Kilkenny who'd figured heavily in that promotion team were elsewhere. It had been decimated and you were left with a squad under Warnock, which had very little razzmatazz about it, very little stardust. It was seriously, seriously depressing. I think the slight difference with Snodgrass was that when he went, it was Warnock's first summer and Warnock had the reputation of somebody who got teams promoted. So you still in the back of your head thought maybe this will work. But by the time Becchio went, you realised that it was absolutely not happening and that Leeds were heading into another period of just mediocre football and mediocre drifting.
It's funny, isn't it? What makes somebody a hero at a club? Obviously, scoring goals helps a great deal. But it's the Argentinian, the suave appearance, the hair, all those stylings, but also playing like an English centre forward. I think that's one of the things that really endeared him to the Leeds fans.
Certainly, initially, you just felt, I think Michael said this, you felt there was that sort of ultra commitment from him. And also, he was involved in promotion, but he was the man on that night against Millwall that scored that goal. And I know ultimately it didn't count for anything in the playoffs, but that moment was absolutely magical. And given the dross either side of it, you know, yes, promotion in that season, but from there onwards, a lot of barren years where Leeds weren't really in the mix for promotion. Prior to that, relegation from the Premier League, relegation from the Championship, defeat in the playoff final, you know, meandering in League One, you had to kind of cling to those moments. And I still say that is the loudest I've ever heard Ellen Road, and we've never had an invasion of the press box quite like it.
Phil's top 10 signings since 2006, that is number 8, Luciano Becchio, following Kisnobo at 10, Snoddy at 9. Tune in next week to find out who is number 7.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So joining us now on the Phil Hay Show, Parag Marate, thank you so much for coming on and joining us, and congratulations as well on a successful first season back in the Premier League.
Thank you. Congratulations to all of us, not just me, but all of us supporters, because it's really for all of us.
You're the president of 49ers Enterprises and vice chairman of Leeds United, for anybody who doesn't know you. So just to give us a little flavour of who you are as a person, so what's your typical match day like then when you're in California? Is it watching Leeds United from the comfort of your bed, from the office, from the bed in the office? Which is it?
Gosh, it really depends what time the match is on. But I will say this, that I don't miss any. So sometimes when these matches are at noon or 12:30 in the UK, it's 4 or 4:30 in the morning. And so at that time, I've got my iPad in my bed, and you know, once or twice or three times in the morning, I'm waking my wife up, much to her chagrin. But most of the time, it's either in my office or on my TV.
So American owners, very much in the news. They've been leading the European Super League breakaway charge. Naturally, it's fostered a little suspicion towards American owners in the Premier League. So what's your message to any Leeds fan who's concerned about 49ers' intentions?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I actually just had tomorrow. I just did a couple of interviews about this, and I have some strong feelings about it. And that is that anyone who was thinking about the Super League, at least, you know, the UK clubs, I just feel like they don't understand what makes English football tick. It's ripping apart the fabric of what makes this special. People want to see their club. They want to celebrate their club when they get promoted, and they actually want to commiserate and they want to be proud of their club and push for their club when they get relegated. It's part of what this is all about. If you don't struggle for something, and if you don't go through the struggle of trying to get somewhere, then you don't appreciate it as much when you get there. And the concept, even the concept of this Big Six, I don't want to say irritates me, but bothers me, because who anointed them the Big Six, right? They are self-anointed, self-proclaimed, because it's at different points in time, there was different Big Six. 15 years ago, the Big Six was actually maybe a Big Four or Five, because two of them weren't in it. 25 years ago, we would have been one of the Big Six. So it's at different points in time. And yet, to get something based on your status today, to guarantee something for the rest of your life. I mean, wouldn't you like to tell your bosses right now, based on what you've achieved, that, hey, you'd like to make this salary for the rest of your life, really, no matter what. And you don't really have to work that hard anymore. That'd be nice to do that. But what have I earned at that point? Right. So I said this in January, and sorry for being so long-winded. I said this in January, and I'll say it again, is that I felt like some of the American counterparts who had invested across Europe, really, is I think maybe they viewed it in an emotionally detached way, where it was really more about buying an apartment building, maybe not visit that building too often, and not really caring about the tenants and just hoping that it appreciates in value. That's just not what sports is about. You have to have your competitive juices going. You have to care about this, because if you don't, there's really no point in being a part of it. And so that's why, like I said to you right before we got recorded, I mean, I'm sitting here hoping to be on a 5-day test and release just so I can attend the West Brom match on Sunday. And I'm so excited to be there, just like all the 6,000-7,000 supporters that are going to be there, because I care. I want to be there. I want to see Leeds United in the Premier League play a match.
Do you feel like you've got that deep understanding now? You've been active in the background for a number of months, years now. Have you got that deep understanding of Leeds United as a club?
I think I have a long ways to go, because, you know, this club has been a part of people's family and a part of people's identity for not just a generation, but multiple generations, right? And it's new to me. It's 3 years, 4 years new to me. But do I have a deep appreciation for it already? Certainly. Has it become part of my identity? Certainly. And, you know, that's something that I really love. And it's different than American sports. It just is. To call English football fans is a disservice to them. And even supporters is almost a disservice. And that's where, you know, I made the comment that we are, that I consider myself just a steward for the supporters, that I really believe that, because this is their club. And it has been part of them. It has been part of their families for multiple generations. And, you know, I experienced it. I was at both of the 2 years ago at the Derby matches, where, you know, we ended up losing in the second leg, and actually, you know, we won the first one. We went up two cumulative goals at Ellen Road when we got back, when we played the second leg, and I felt the pain. You know, I was eating takeaway curry in my hotel that night, ready to take my flight home the next day. I was just depressed, you know, and I felt it. And then, you know, to compare that with the fans who have gone through that for 16, or I guess at 14 years at that point, before it having got 15 years and that having gone up, like I can't say that I'm with them, that I completely understand it, but I certainly appreciate it.
So as a steward for the club, then what's your vision for Leeds United in, let's say, I don't know, 5 years, let's say?
I think it's a multi-phased approach. The first was for us to be able to get promoted, right? And now the next phase that we're in right now is to show that we belong. And not just show that we belong, that we can hang around by the laces of our shoes and be 16th, 17th, but really show that we can compete and can compete with, you know, all levels of the table. And I think we've shown that. And I think the goal wasn't necessarily where in the table we'll finish, but the goal is to show that we can be competitive. And with Andrea's vision and Coach Bielsa and Victor's leadership on the pitch, and it, our mindset has shifted. And I don't know if the supporters have seen it, but it certainly feels like even from the second half of our season relative to our first half, the mindset shifted. The way that we played those games against the top table clubs, it changed. It was just a different mindset. And I think I'm excited about next season because I feel like we have a certain confidence now. And so to answer your question specifically about 5 years from now, you know, at that point, I hope we are competing for Europe and for Champions League year in and year out.
And what do you think you can provide from a 49ers perspective then to make Leeds United competitive over the next 5 years?
You know, one benefit in a lot of ways, we've been there and we've done that. I've been with the 49ers going on 21 years now. And on and off the pitch, I've helped transform us from in 2001 when I first started. We were a club that had storied history with five world, Super Bowl trophies, world championships. And but I'd fallen on hard times on the field in our case. And we had played, we were playing in the oldest unrenovated stadium in the NFL. It took us a decade, decade and a half, but we got back to, you know, play, we built a new stadium and we brought our club back to a position where every year we're competing for a Super Bowl. That's that we put together that can apply to help us here, here across the pond. And we feel like there's just a lot of ways and places that we can help bring a level of sophistication to the club on and off the pitch that will help them.
So the stadium, I guess, will be the cornerstone of pushing those revenues up, getting more fans inside the stadium. How far do you think you're prepared to go in terms of that renovation? Are we looking now at wholesale stadium redevelopment?
There's a delicate balance here, Dan. It's really that, yes, there are things that we could do to modernize the stadium and to increase capacity, you know, hopefully get us increased to get to above 50,000. Angus has talked about that over the last few months. But we have to maintain the special elements of what we have in a 100-year-old Ellen Road that is a menacing environment for opposing team players. And it is a difficult place to play because our supporters make it a difficult place to play. And what we have to be careful, when I say delicate balance, we have to be careful to not make it just a sterile environment because we want to increase revenues for the club. We want to increase revenues, yes, but we want to maintain that magic in a bottle that we have to really keep that competitive advantage that we really feel strongly about, you know. And that's one thing that I'm really excited about is we managed to have a successful season without our great competitive advantage that is Ellen Road. I can't wait for Sunday because 6,500 fans are going to build us a competitive advantage players haven't seen in 37 games.
Parag, what does that look like in real world terms then? How do you preserve those things in the stands? How do we keep that atmosphere?
That's a great question. I think that for some, our main supporters and everyone we have to keep it loud. We have to keep it, we have to keep fans close to the pitch. We have to maintain all of that. You know, sometimes you, when you make a stadium too sterile, you're putting too much premium. You're putting too much of something in an area where it's, you just don't lose that volume. Right. And something that's great about Ellen Road, it's built almost up, right? Yeah. So you're almost either right by the pitch or you're on top of the pitch. Right. And that really creates a great environment. That's something that, I remember we were very conscious of when we were building Levi's Stadium for the 49ers in that we also had because we had a relatively smaller footprint, we built it up. And what that meant is our fans were right there being able to create that menacing environment. And so we have to make sure that we maintain that.
Well, we look forward to Ellen Road being a bear pit in years to come and hopefully being at the top end of the Premier League. And Parag, best of luck with the project. I think we're all right behind you at the minute.
Awesome. I can't wait to get there on Sunday.
We're joined now on The Phil Hayes Show by James Horncastle. James, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Talk about him then. Tell me about that sweet, sweet footballer from Argentina. You know the one. You've interviewed him. It's the article that is on The Athletic right now. Rodrigo De Paul, where you put to him the links to Leeds.
Yeah, I was shouted down. I was the Zoom call almost ended when I asked. I left that right until the end of the interview with DePaul, and I thought the press officer might have dozed off, but no. I mean, the interesting thing was, as soon as I mentioned it, I think he must have known that it was coming, because he smiled. And yeah, I mean, he was very guarded. He did say, look, I'm relaxed about it. There's been lots and lots of talk, which, you know, ultimately he did kind of fuel by replying to one of your tweets over at the Square Ball. But yeah, I think this story runs and runs, even though I think at the time Phil and I kind of looked into it and it didn't seem to be ever really an advanced stage. But I can't remember a player generating this much kind of interest on Twitter. You know, in all my years kind of reporting on Serie A, just following European football, I can't remember. I mean, I've had literally one Twitter account pretty much every day for the last 6 months ask me about Rodrigo De Paul.
I'd like to just stress that's not me, by the way.
Your burner account.
Because it's behind an avatar and it's a name like De Paul LUFC. So, yeah.
Why do you think it never got off the ground with Leeds then? Was it simply a matter of economics? Because the vibe we got from Angus Kinnear when we've spoken to him over the last few months was there are lots of players you make an inquiry about, some go somewhere, others don't, which I took to mean that an inquiry had perhaps been placed, you know, about how much would you be looking for, and they've balked at the price perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, Udinese are still a very well-run club, even though they haven't sort of been challenging for Europe in a while, you know, really since Di Natale retired. A lot of the guys that they've gone and signed have actually moved on and done really, really well elsewhere. So I think, you know, they don't need to sell, unlike a lot of other Italian clubs who are, you know, live hand to mouth. You know, I mean, yeah, it's hard for a lot of them to get to the end of the month. Yes, you know, they're really dependent on kind of player trading, whereas Udinese aren't. We had a piece, kind of an in-depth piece on their whole project really a couple of weeks ago, which is kind of how this interview came about. And, you know, they do everything. I mean, it sounds really banal, but they do everything to make sure that their players are really happy and their families are settled. And I think that certainly for De Paul, there was no real urgency to leave. And, you know, I mean, his manager, Luca Gotti, said, look, you know, it was quite an odd period, really, last summer, last autumn, because you were still, what, only maybe 3 or 4 months into a pandemic. There were all these restrictions around. You didn't know how much you could travel. Clubs didn't know how much money they had. His girlfriend had just got pregnant. You know, I think the idea of moving in this period, where you can't, for example, you know, I mean, if he'd moved to Leeds, let's say, he wouldn't have really been able to travel around outside the bubble that Leeds players have been in because of kind of COVID restrictions. He wouldn't have got to you know, sort of enjoy what Leeds has and West Yorkshire has to offer. So I think all those kind of things played a part. And also, I do think there's some big interest in him from top Italian teams and some, let's say, Champions League qualifiers in Spain, which he was advised to maybe, yeah, wait another year, and these clubs that have been hit by the pandemic will be able to come back again. Yeah, throwing forward to this summer, I think the advantage always lies with Italian clubs when you've got a guy like De Paul at Udinese, because you'll always have an Inter, you'll always have a Juventus. You can basically say, here are two of our really good young players, or a guy who's really good but maybe not good enough for us. We'll package that together. We'll throw in maybe another 5, 10, 15 million, whatever, and we'll do the deal that way. And I think all of those things, maybe waiting to see how things played out post the pandemic that we're still kind of coming out of, had a bearing on it as well.
So do you expect him to move this summer? It feels like the timing is of the essence with him now, given the age that he is.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that is it's good that you bring up his age, because I think some of the smarter clubs look at that and think, hang on a minute, Udinese are going to ask again for, let's say, between 35, 40 million. He'll want an increase in his salary, and that's going to be a significant outlay. even for a big Italian club in this kind of environment. And if we give him 3-4 year contract, he's going to be 30, 31 by the time that comes to an end. Are we going to ever get that kind of money back, I suppose? So some clubs are asking themselves that question. I do think now, after 3 or 4 years at Udinese, he does feel that it's time to move on, just because this is a player who should be playing in Europe or, let's say, on a bigger stage than at Udinese. I think if he has a strong, I mean, I don't think he even needs to have a very good Copa America to get a move. And also, I mean, there were reports a month ago that he'd had coffee with Mino Raiola, you know, one of the super agents. Raiola is someone who can open doors to the Premier League, to big clubs. I mean, it's quite interesting when we had Raiola on, we did an interview with him a few months ago, and he said, "I don't take any of my young players to the Premier League just because the pressure there is high in terms of expectations on managers. Yeah, that discourages them from playing young players." But Depaul's 26, 20, 27, so he's ready. So, yeah, I would be very, very surprised if he's still an Udinese player come the start of next season.
Will he be at Leeds, though? That's the big one.
Well, I'm curious. I'm still curious about this. I think, obviously, Bielsa, his presence, his continued presence at Leeds, if he does sign a new deal, he's obviously a massive attraction for any player, but I think particularly for an Argentine player. And whenever Radrizzani speaks, you know, Radrizzani always says that, you know, the goal isn't just to be a team that fights against relegation and survives at the end of the year in the Premier League. You know, he wants to push on and get the team into Europe. And to be honest, I mean, you know, Depaul is the kind of player who would, I think, make that sort of a difference. So it depends on budget. Now, ultimately, Leeds have stayed up. Yeah, they haven't gone straight back down. They will be able to count on Premier League money yet again. At the moment, I think it's still quite a fluid situation. And I don't really know what Leeds' appetite is for meeting that asking price, which is still very high from Udinese. We'll have to see.
Well, I mean, Angus Kinnear would have us believe when we spoke to him on last week's show that there's no real appetite for it. But from what you've said there, James, I'm taking it that on that Zoom call, he blinked the letters L-E-E-D-S at you in Morse code with his eyelids. So we look forward to him signing on July the 1st then. Thanks very much for joining us, James.
Cheers, guys.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
Back with Josh Warrington now, and we're back at Elland Road, finally, after a long wait against West Brom on Sunday, and finally we start to experience the Elland Road crowd. It's going to be a small crowd, Josh, but you know, we're actually talking 3 years almost to the day when you fought Selby at Elland Road, and
yes. You
enjoyed that crowd yourself. How important is it?
A crowd is massive. A crowd is massive, and like I say, especially when you get used to that crowd. No, I've over recent times, and last fight, I've experienced not fighting in front of a crowd, and I've not experienced that in such a long time. Listen, having the crowd behind you is unbelievable. I've certainly grown into it now. When I started coming through, I had a few fans following me, and then I'd started to build a bit of a fan base in Leeds when I'd won English title, and then it just went another level when I'd signed with Matchroom initially. And I didn't know how to handle it. You know, I'd gone from fighting in front of like 1,500 people in leisure centres to fighting in front of 10,000. And at one point, I was still working a 9-to-5 job, and I had 10,000 at Leeds Arena. I had Vinnie Jones doing ring walk and I'm doing interviews with national press. And I remember turning up to them shows like in 2014, 2015, absolutely bricking it, because I'm thinking to myself, all these people are paying their hard-earned money and I've got to impress them, make them enjoy the night. But I felt it put pressure on my own shoulders then. I'd feel really nervous. And I'd kind of think to myself, oh, buddy, why can't I just fight in gym somewhere quiet and just get it over and done with and then maybe stream it on telly after. But over years, you get used to it. Experience is the best teacher. You know, you start doing little things a little bit different. Like I used to turn up to venue like three hours before the fight. Then I shortened that down. So I didn't need to be there 3 hours before. I could be there for an hour and 45. That's enough time for me to get warm and get ready. And then you start to build a bit of resilience and all of a sudden you're not getting nervous when you're walking into venue. You're enjoying the occasion. You're not nervous when you're sat in change rooms. You're having a laugh and a giggle. You know, you start switching on when you need to switch on and not burning that excess energy. You know, when you walk into the ring, you learn to not try too hard to impress them, but take the energy from the crowd and use that energy and stick to your own game plan. But if you need that lift and you can hear them screaming and shouting, then use that lift and use that boost if you need it. And we often, we've seen it down Ellen Road, when it's bouncing and the lads have got the back up, it's a wave of energy. It's crazy. But all right, let's have a look at the game a few weeks back against Man United when some of them challenges were going in. Like, referees are only human being. But when there's like a 40,000 wave of noise, it's going to have a difference on what cards he's going to pull out. Is he going to be as leaning as pulling cards out to Leeds players? Should he send some of the Man United players off of some of the disgusting challenges they're pulling? And you look at it then in the comparison, obviously they were playing behind closed doors, so nobody there. But if there'd been 40,000 there, maybe he could have got the lads a little bit more pumped up, getting any challenges, getting straight back up and maybe pushing a little bit harder for a ball. So having a fan base and a crowd is absolutely fantastic. So I'm going off course there a little bit, but it is fantastic to have, and I'd rather have it than rather not, you know.
Well, to draw parallels with your own experience, the fight against Lara in February this year is the one that you lost. And do you think the lack of crowd affected your performance on the night? And, you know, trying to draw parallels with what Leeds United have experienced, it obviously hasn't affected them in that sense, but could it have been even better with people in?
Yeah, I think so, mate. I think so. Like, I don't want to say that I can only fight in front of a crowd, because like I say, in the first part of my career, I didn't have that many people behind. I mean, one time fighting in Manchester, I had four people come watch me, you know? So it's not always been that big crowd. But like I said to you, I've got accustomed to it. I've got used to it. Now, fighting behind closed doors, it was probably one thing I overlooked. I expected myself to be as pumped up doing the ring walk as I normally am. And I'm laughing and joking with, you know, I've left my change rooms, I'm laughing and joking with the floor manager of Sky Sports, who said, you know, wait here 10 seconds, wait for the announcer. And normally I'd be laughing and joking in corridors of the Leeds Arena, or laughing and joking in like Ellen Road. And then when it's time to go and I see people's faces, that's when I switch on and I see the passion and I see them screaming and shouting and it sets me off. Now, I get onto that ramp down in London and I stand on top of there and I kind of forgot myself for a split second. I forgot that I wasn't walking out in front of thousands of people. And I kind of played this over in my head a few times, but I never didn't prepare myself for what exactly I saw. And all I saw were the ring and bloody hazmat suits all over, you know, people in the white boiler suits, and that was it. And like I say, when I get up there, when I come out of the back corridors and I jump onto the ramp and I'm seeing like thousands of people screaming and shouting, that's when it's switched on. For me, I tell myself, it's time to go work now, Josh, it's time to go work. And I get up there on the ramp and it wasn't coming. That rush of adrenaline wasn't coming. The switch on wasn't there, but I knew I had a job to do. So I walked to the ring and get in the ring and I'm thinking it'll come now when I'm in the ring. I predict to right players out, Mike shouldn't give a players out, and I'm pumped by the time I get to the ring, but it didn't happen this time. And then, you know, I'm bouncing off the ropes. I'm looking about, and I'm seeing nobody. I'm just seeing posters on the wall, and that's it. And it's little things like that what you kind of take for granted. And I think I done that night. Like, don't get me wrong, if I had to fight behind closed doors again, I've experienced it now. But that was certainly a little bit of shock to the system for myself going into that fight. And I certainly missed the fans that night.
When we lifted the championship trophy, it's not quite a year ago now because of the strange calendar with COVID, but you were inside the stadium and otherwise, you know, mostly empty stadium. Can you tell us what that was like?
Yeah, I felt like, oh man, I felt, Dan, when you say it, I feel a little bit dirty. I feel a little bit seedy because I abused my position and able to get in there. The first time and probably last time I'd do that. But yeah, it was unbelievable, to be fair. I'd met up with the players a few weeks back when Huddersfield got beat. When Huddersfield beat West Brom. Because I was out with the missus for a bite to eat. And I think that was one of our first meals out since the first lockdown. And then I listened to BBC Radio Leeds and obviously we got promoted. We had a meal in town and I was just sat there numb. And I said to her, I said, listen, after this meal, we need to drive past the Lim Road. And she said, what for, you weirdo? And she said, I said, I just need to feel the vibes off the stadium. We've been promoted. And when I turned up there, so did bloody 50,000 other people just hanging up outside the stadium, letting off fireworks and that. And I got a call off one of the directors saying, come on in, you need to be part of these celebrations. I don't know why, but fortunate enough to get in. Then I got invited down for the Charlton game. Now that was a bit weird. I actually seen Phil down there for later because I was in the media doing that stuff. I was sat behind all the Charlton squad because obviously the one in the dugout, they're all in the stand. It was a little bit weird, really. It was just like watching Leeds, but in kind of a Sunday league environment where you can hear managers screaming and shouting and carrying on. You can hear the players from sidelines carrying on, but you're not hearing massive roars of the crowd as well. And then towards the back end, that was a little bit, again, something that was a little bit weird was, obviously, we've become champions and we get to lift the cup and whatnot, the trophy. And then looking down and seeing all them boys in front of me just putting their head in their hands because the inevitable is coming and they're getting relegated. But yeah, it was surreal to see them all there, like I say, lift the trophy, all celebrating and cheering after. And I think it was a bit of relief for a lot of them because I think they were worried what was going to happen with lockdown and they probably started to believe things like, it was going to get, the league was going to get wrote off and this and other, and then the momentum they had before lockdown was going to kind of flourish and it give other teams to get up. And it was just a relief for them to get it over the line and obviously finish the way that they did.
When we spoke to Angus Kinnear last week, he was saying that the players felt like they'd been robbed of a promotion moment. Did you get that sense as well from speaking to the boys in the camp?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, obviously, I think they were just happy to do it more than anything, but it comes to the back end, doesn't it? Because you've got to really weigh it up. Now, with that Barnes game, weren't they? Where they had a right old 10 minutes in the second half where they really, really, really came at us. Now, think of that in front of a crowd. And we're all talking as Leeds fans here. We know what our fan base is like. We have some unbelievable fans, like I say, but we have some pretty fickle fans as well, who are quick to let the voices heard.
We've got nervous. We've got nervous fans, haven't we? That's what we've got.
That's what we said at the time, wasn't it? If the end of that game would have been unbearable.
Exactly. And that could have had an opposite effect on us because that spills on. I don't care what anyone says. That spills onto the pitch. You know, I've spoke to the lads and heard that firsthand. They says they feel it. You know, when people are getting the backup because you know they've missed a shot or, you know, the missed a challenge or whatever has happened, it's going to have an effect. And when there's a few thousand of them, Dave, shouting that, you know, it creates a noise, it creates a bad atmosphere and it makes people a bit restless. And that would have spilled onto the pitch. So probably the way that the season finished, it would have been a good thing that the crowd weren't there. But I think they may have been robbed because obviously so many fans are wanting to see that. You listen, even myself, I feel a bit dirty after I'd been watching them lift the cup because I felt, you know, there's people who've been going to Leeds longer than I've been alive. Who, like I say, who've never missed a game, who've been home and away, have travelled Europe, and they'd done anything to see that moment. So I did feel a bit dirty, to be honest with you, for them. Even me old Nana, I said in past, I'll probably won't say Leeds United back in Premier League in my time. And she's been going for years and years and years, you know. So I think the fans more than anything have really been robbed.
Just to relate it to your own experience again, like if you imagine that Selby fight, which I imagine is probably like one of the best days of your life. If you imagine that same thing behind closed doors, I know boxing is a very individual sport. So would you have felt the same about that if it had just happened in an empty arena somewhere, then the way it actually unfolded at Elland Road and Kaiser Chiefs, Lucas Radebe, all that, how would that have compared, do you think, to you?
I had to say is that because there's quite a few events throughout that day where the fans were kind of involved and what made me more relaxed. Now, I wanted to punch Selby's in anyway. I didn't like it. So. I could have done it in my back garden, to be honest with you. But that with the fans, I just added a little bit more. For instance, I was pretty nervous. Nerves that had not come back to me. Well, nerves that had come back to me and that I thought I'd got over. Nerves like, if I get beat here tonight at Elland Road, how the hell can I go down to the ground and watch Leeds again? It hurt me to be sat in my seat and just looking at the pitch, knowing that I got beat there. I'd let all these people down who've come to support me. I'd feel embarrassed going for going for a pie or a piss at half time because I'd have to walk past people and what would they say? It's all right, Josh is always next time. Well, they're in the next time, is it? Because I've been beat, you know. Even walking around City Centre, it killed me to just look at people. I'd be so embarrassed. But then I'd met a couple of my pals who'd been into City Centre, and I don't normally do that on fight day, but someone was just different on this day. So I'd met up with them, and it just calmed my nerves a little bit because they said, you know what, Josh, town is absolutely buzzing. Everyone's chanting your name. Everyone's going to fight. So it made me a little bit more relaxed out. So obviously fans are involved there. Then when I pulled up to the ground, I got off my little coach at the West Sand, and when I pulled up, there were around a couple of thousand fans waiting for my appearance, and that gave me a boost as well. And then when I walked into the ring, you know, I've kind of got off blinkers on, so I'm not really seeing people as I'm walking initially. I'm just blurred vision. But when I got into the ring, my old fella turned around to me and he said, listen, just have a minute, take it all in. And he says, then when he gets in, you switch on. So that's what I did. I took my gown off. I'll look over to the cop. You know, I look down at ringside, I look over to east, I look over to west. I'm seeing people who are there with me. They're there with me. I can see the passion on the faces. They want it as bad as me. Obviously, a few of them have had a fair few shandies. So they're proper tanked up. But I'm looking down at people at ringside, and some people, you know, regular faces, and some people I might not meet again, but they're there with me. And I can see it, and they're looking in my eyes, and I'm catching eyes with them, and they're more or less mouthing, come on, Josh, let's have it. And I can see the energy. But then, all in this moment, I hear, you know, marching, and it's just echoing around, and all of a sudden, bam, I'm back in zone, and I've gone up another level. I feel like, kind of like I've just had a pint myself, and I'm all pumped up. Do you know what I mean? I hear that, and it's the second wind has kicked in there, and I'm all of a sudden back in it. And that's it. I hear that wall of noise and I'm battling again. And even in 11th round, you know, I was getting pretty tired. I'd burnt a lot of energy in the fight. I'd gone at quite a decent pace. You know, mentally, it'd been a long build-up. I had massive blisters on bottom of my feet, which I could feel through my boots. I had a new pair of boots on. And even again, towards back end, they were chanting, you know, "Wardy, Wardy." And going into all different lead songs, and all of a sudden you're wearing that, and it's you're just feeding off it. It doesn't become tiredness no more because you're more focused on that. I think that gives you a little bit of an idea of how it can affect me in that kind of sense.
I guess it all circles back nicely to West Brom actually, and the fact that basically, when all said and done, when the Leeds crowd is behind you, there's nothing better in the world. It's the greatest fuel. You're going to feel superhuman when that's going on. And I presume then, because I'm going to ask you for a prediction for the West Brom game, it's going to be a home win, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel pretty much comfortable. I feel that the way we've been playing, and if you're going off of form, you know, they're getting relegated. So for them, obviously, they would be on a finish. It'd be nice for their fans, you know, obviously they're going to be there, but it's been nice for their fans to just see a beat Leeds who would inform and everyone's talking about them. But I can't see it happening, mate. I can't see this winning pretty comfortably. I'd like to say 3-0 if you're going to ask for a score prediction. I think they'll give the fans a little bit of actual live viewing of what they've been doing all season. So, yeah, I feel they've come to a win.
Fingers crossed. Thanks, Josh. We really appreciate you coming on the Phil Hayes Show. We'll catch up with you again sometime. And Victor Orta's on next week, and he's a character. I know that you shared a moment with him around the championship trophy lift, didn't you? So we look forward to that.
Yeah, he's a top man, actually. And you know what? There's been a few instances, weirdly so, because like Victor's Victor. We see all this in the stands, and it pains me when I've read a bit of shit about him over the years when people are saying they don't care about club, because I've been in his presence, you know, prawn sarnish seats when I've been invited by a club to sit in them white seats, and I've seen him, you know, knocking 7 bells out of his chair. when we need to conceal the goal, and then how high he gets when we've scored. So I've also shared moments away with him away from the club, and you know, this is somebody who was always absolutely obsessed with it. You know, one time I went for a little bit of lunch with him, and he just wanted to pick my head on sport psychology, on like my thing of like building up to fights and fighting from the leads to kind of understand what it's like to be someone else in a different field, but if still in front of the Leeds fans. And I found that, you know, obviously I enjoyed speaking to him and whatnot, but he only after bang on his heart, because he wants to find so much about what this city is about and how it can apply little bits and bats to the team to make it. Obviously it's Marcelo who's, you know, the main man, but just putting that philosophy across to the team, it's something special. So I think only now people are really starting to appreciate or to like.
Definitely, I think so, and we look forward to seeing what the summer brings. Josh, thank you very much, we really appreciate it.
No worries, lads. Cheers, mate.
The Phil Hayes Show.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.